This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Russia, of course, is back. It's back in the news, back in our concerns and fears, back as a subject that we're trying anew to understand. And we're very fortunate to have with us this evening a journalist who's distinguished herself over several decades as one of the best chroniclers and explainers of Russia, its leaders, and its people. Masha Gessen is the daughter of Soviet dissidents and was born in Moscow. She moved to the United States with her family as a teenager in 1981, then returned a decade later to work there as a journalist, then moved back to the United States several years ago. Throughout her career, which has included not only many, many articles, but 8 previous books, Masha has time and again shown herself to be as courageous as she is eloquent, an unrelenting thorn in the side of the Russian authorities, in particular Vladimir Putin, and a determined advocate for democracy and LGBT rights. In her new book, The Future is History, Masha sets out to capture what it has felt like to live in Russia over the past 3 decades of considerable change, and what Russia has become today. She does this by focusing on the lives of several people, 4 younger ones who grew up during the 1990s when Russia was opening up, then came of age when the country started shutting down again, and 3 older individuals, a sociologist, a psychoanalyst, and a philosopher, who not only are old enough to have experienced the Soviet Union, but are in a position, because of their intellectual training, to reflect on what's happened in Russia. The result is a book that a reviewer in the New York Times called, quote, fascinating and deeply felt, a book that was just named a finalist for this year's National Book Award in nonfiction. Masha will be in conversation here this evening with Susan Glasser, Politico's chief international affairs columnist and host of a new weekly podcast, The Global Politico. Over Susan's long and distinguished journalism career, she also has reported for or edited Roll Call, The Washington Post, and Foreign Policy Magazine. Particularly relevant for this evening's discussion, Susan, while at the Washington Post, spent 4 years traveling the former Soviet Union as co-chief of the Moscow Bureau. And if you haven't seen it already, she's also written a review of Masha's book that is for the Washington Post that just went online today. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Masha Gessen and Susan Glasser.
Thank you so much, Brad, and Lisa, and all of you especially for sharing your busy evening with us. I'm impressed that so many of you managed to make it through our Washington gridlock and come tonight, and very grateful because I think this should be a great conversation. I've been looking forward to it just because I'm looking forward to talking with Masha and hearing what she has to think. There's been, you know, it's another busy week here in Trump's Washington, so we have a lot of questions that I have, and we'll get to that, questions from the audience as well. But it's a great honor to see Masha here, and this big, ambitious book, as Brad, I think I heard you say, as you mentioned, I did review this book for the Post, and so you can see what I think of it there, but, you know, I'll sneak preview, it was a very positive review.
It would otherwise be a little bit of an awkward conversation.
Well,
with
exactly.
The review having been published an hour ago.
Just to actually, I told my editor I was doing this, and I said, you know, just Masha and I have met each other a few times, but you know, we're not old friends or anything. And I said, you know, when are you planning to publish this? And actually, they didn't tell me. It was all done and finished and signed off on. And I guess this is what they mean when there is an absolute, you know, blind wall here. So. There's no connection between this event and the review. But
But thank you.
The book has gotten, I think, rightly a lot of acclaim. It was just announced that it's a finalist this week. And my observation would be, and I'm curious if you can start out tonight by telling us a little bit, you know, it's one of the most ambitious books that I've read about the Putin era in particular, right? There are a lot of very ambitious books about the Cold War. There are a lot of ambitious books about Russian history. I really can't think of anything that aims to tell in such big detail the story of what's happened in the last 17 years. And I start out the piece by saying, you might not have noticed it, but a few weeks ago, a landmark was quietly passed, and Vladimir Putin became the longest-serving Russian leader since Stalin. He outpaced even Brezhnev's record, who we associate as having been the leader of the Soviet Union forever. So, since Stalin, how did you decide now is the time that I'm going to write this big, cinematic, ambitious book about Putin's Russia?
I wasn't actually timing it for the record, and I wasn't timing it for his, as you pointed out in your review, assured re-election next year. The timing was a little bit of a personal matter. I left Russia, and I thought I should write one last book about Russia. And, you know, every couple of years, somebody writes a Russia book to end all Russia books. So I thought, this is my turn. and you're right. I mean, it's more ambitious than other books I've written, because for me, you know, in the sort of the solipsistic way that writers have, I think that what's my story, for me, marks an end of an era. So I think it's the end of an era. And for me, the end of the era was sort of the era of hoping for a democracy in Russia. I went back to Russia in the early 1990s, having immigrated here as a teenager. I went back 10 years later in the early 90s as a reporter because it was so exciting to report on the transformation of the Soviet Union into a democratic Russia, or so we thought.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Reading it now, you know, the two parts of the book that are really the strongest in many ways are that period in the 1980s when there's this incredible ferment, at least in the sort of Moscow intelligentsia circles, you know, new ideas are opening up. You have a wonderful character in the book who basically brings psychoanalysis to a country that, you know, if ever a country needed therapy, right? but, you know, so you experience this awakening, this opening, this, you know, glasnost and perestroika. And then the last few years are sort of like the bookend, right, to the beginning of that. Did you struggle much with what the opening point of the book should be, like how far back to go, or was it meant to be your own kind of lived experience?
It's not really my own lived experience, although you're right, it's a very personal book, but the word I is never in the book. It's a book that's, I feel like people are having trouble hearing me. Is that what's happening? Is this better? How do I make this? Yeah, okay. Not really? Is there anything we can do about this? Should I move? Yeah. Okay. Tell me what to do. Okay. Okay, how's this? Yeah, is this working? No? Is this working?
It's better.
Okay.
It's
better. All right. How's this? Okay, this gave me lots of time to think about this question. the book is the book begins in the mid-80s when Russia started changing, right? And sort of in the traditional narrative, that was the beginning of the end. I think in my narrative, it has turned out to be not the beginning of the end. It turned out to be a little bit of a false start, right? But it's only 30 years later that we realize that it was a false start. But that's how I chose the mid-80s. And of course, I also chose the mid-80s because the four characters around whom the book is built were all born in the mid-80s. I looked for people who were born then, not for the symbolic, not for the symbolism of looking at people who are as old as the story, but because I really was interested for a long time in writing about people who were children in the 1990s. Because I think it's such an interesting moment, and I wanted to get inside the heads of people who were children in the 1990s and try to figure out what happened there.
Well, and would you say there's something that binds those four very disparate characters together? I mean, they grew up in very different places, in a provincial city, in Moscow, as a member of sort of a very elite family. Do they strike you as having something that is generational in nature to their experience?
So I actually had some criteria when I looked for people who would be at the center of the book. I figured out at one point that I wanted four people, and I wanted people who had been children in the 90s. They had to remember 1991. Right? So not every person who was a child in the 90s remembers the moment that we think of as the end of the Soviet Union. And another almost formal criterion was that their lives had to have changed drastically as a result of the crackdown of the last 5 years. So that's probably the thing that really binds them together. That obviously means that they're all in some way or another in opposition to Putin, which for that brief moment in 2011, 2012, and for their generation, made them part of a majority. So, you know, I wasn't looking for truly exceptional people, but I wanted people who represented that particular phenomenon, the protests of 2011, 2012, and the crackdown that dashed their hopes, and in these cases, really profoundly changed their lives.
So one thing I've been thinking about all day, it's not sort of the text of the book, but it's certainly one of the major questions that's raised by it. Was that crackdown inevitable? And was this particular trajectory inevitable for Russia?
In hindsight, everything is inevitable, right? Because it happened. I remember very well what I thought at the time. And unfortunately, I will never be able to forget what I thought at the time, because my Putin book that came out, the biography that came out in 2012, had as its epilogue a very hopeful piece on the protests. Because at that moment, and I learned my lesson once and for all, never put in a book something that you just wrote about something that just happened. Like, it has to sit. But I was inside those protests. They felt amazing. I also fell victim to heuristic, which is that I had covered revolutions, right? Several of them. And I knew what it felt like to be inside a successful revolution. So it didn't occur to me to ask myself, what does it feel like to be inside an unsuccessful revolution? As it turns out, it feels exactly the same, except it fails. Obviously, 5 years ago, I didn't think it was inevitable. Now I think that I should have been smarter. I think that knowing what I knew about Putin's absolute drive to absolute power, to imagine that he would be motivated by the protests to weaken the system in ways that would eventually lead to his downfall, was naive, right? And that really was the expectation, because he already had all the levers of power in his hands. So the imagination was that he would negotiate with the protesters, he would try to appease them, and that would eventually bring him down. Well, he's not a very smart man, but he's smart enough to understand that that would eventually have brought him down. And that for a dictator, cracking down is actually a more effective strategy of survival.
You know, it's interesting you say that. To me, that was one of the early lessons that I learned, never really understanding where Putin exactly would take this, but I remember, I'm not sure if you were still in Moscow then, probably at the time, but when in Azerbaijan, one of the former Soviet republics, the Soviet-era leader, Aliyev, Haidar Aliyev, died, and he sought to pass his country on to his son, which, in fact, he succeeded at doing. And I went down for the election, and, you know, his son was not popular at all. He was sort of seen as a playboy. He was Western-educated. He was, you know, a sort of a worldly sort, but not at all seen as, you know, fit to lead a country. And so there was unhappiness that was genuine and that even, you know, the regime people would tell you. Went to this election. It was a totally rigged election. There was protests in the streets. You know, people's heads were cracked right in front of me. But it was the lesson that I took away from it was on the plane going back, and there were some Western election observers and some Russian election observers on the plane back to Moscow. And the Europeans said, we don't understand. I mean, you know, why were they so greedy? Why did Aliyev have to give himself 85% of the vote? Nobody thinks that he really got 85%. You know, couldn't they have done 55? And he said this to the Russian. He said, you don't understand. The 85% was the point. The fact that people knew he wasn't very popular and that this had to be, you know, an orchestrated result. The higher the percentage, the better. I'm amazed they didn't go for 90%. And it was this very revealing moment to me where I realized that, you know, the things that are necessary to dictate the survival of an authoritarian government are very different than, you know, certainly that product of the United States is used to thinking. And Putin has always struck me as playing more by Aliyev's law than we realize. So, based on this book, I know every single person here is going to stand up and ask you this question, so I'll just ask it for you anyways. You know, why do you think Putin has taken what appears to be such an aggressive outward turn? You know, not just focusing on cracking down inside Russia and, you know, making sure no more Bolotnaya protests break out, but focusing on the United States to a degree that clearly has shocked many people here in Washington. This Saturday, it will be the one-year anniversary not only of the Access Hollywood tape, which I'm sure everyone here remembers, but it will also be the one-year anniversary of when the U.S. government said Russia had done the hacking of the DNC, the one-year anniversary of the leak of John Podesta's emails, and it's Vladimir Putin's birthday.
And the 11th anniversary of the murder of Anna Politkovskaya. I think that actually, in echoing what you were just saying about Aliyev's election, the outward turn was the point, right? I believe, and I discussed this at length in the book, I believe that the nature of the regime changed after the crackdown. It went from being an authoritarian regime to a kind of totalitarian regime, right? When I say kind of totalitarian, I don't mean that he was establishing a new totalitarian regime, right? That would involve terror and, you know, just all sorts of unimaginable horror. But he was calling forth the habits and customs of Soviet totalitarian society. And one of the differences between an authoritarian and a totalitarian regime that I think is key here is mobilization. Right. And in an authoritarian regime, nothing is political. The authoritarian leader wants people to stay home, tend to their private lives, and not pay attention while he plunders the country, consolidates power, or whatever it is he's doing. A totalitarian leader wants the exact opposite. Everything is political. There is no private realm. And the totalitarian leader wants people out in the public square rallying for a victory, right? The population has to be mobilized. And you know, there are lots of reasons why it has to be mobilized, but the question is, how does it get mobilized? And it only can get mobilized against an enemy. And the only enemy that is big enough and glorious enough to be mobilized against is the United States. And I think that's something that the foreign policy establishment in this country really failed to understand was that was the nature of the war in Ukraine. You know, Russians believed that they were fighting a proxy war with the United States in Ukraine and in Syria. And so in that sense, you know, the intense interest and participation in the American election is just completely logical. It's not, you know, it's not a break with the narrative. It's part of the narrative, especially because Russia believes that the United States has meddled in its own politics, has, you know, that Hillary Clinton personally organized protests in the streets in 2011, 2012. And so why shouldn't Russia do the same here?
Okay, so you brought up the T word, as in totalitarianism, which is the subtitle of your book, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. You know, you had to have done that recognizing that some people would get in an argument over definitions with you, and that, you know, Vladimir Putin is many things. You've described them well in your previous book, but he has not killed millions of people.
Right. So that's why I wrote a whole chapter on the definition of totalitarianism, chapter 14. So here's my theory of the case. I think that Putin certainly did not set out to be a totalitarian leader. In fact, the regime that he was trying to build is a mafia state. And this is, I think this is the best definition. Again, there have been many. There are oligarchy, kleptocracy, crony capitalism, a liberal democracy. I think that they're all flawed, and the best one is the mafia state. And this is a definition put forward by a Hungarian political scientist named Balin Magyar, who describes it as a clan, a family run by a patriarch. The patriarch distributes money and power. And you know, the amazing thing, and since this, people are going to ask about this as well, I'll just go ahead and say it. The amazing thing, of course, is when I was writing the book and writing about mafia state, the concept of family was a metaphor. Right.
You're talking about the other T word.
I wasn't thinking that, you know, we would be observing the formation of a mafia state with a literal family at the helm. But so he was building a mafia state. His goal continues to be to retain power in perpetuity and to continue enriching himself. But because to do that, he had to crack down in 2012. And because he cracked down on the ruins of a totalitarian society, the response he got was the survival response of a totalitarian society. It's very much like a person who has been in an abusive situation develops survival skills that are suited to that situation. And those are the skills that person is going to use throughout their life, unless something extraordinary like really great therapy happens to this person. But as Susan already mentioned, Russia needed a lot of therapy, didn't get a lot of therapy. The survival skills of a totalitarian society were perfectly suited for the period of state terror. And the thing that I think we have discovered in the last 20 years is that they have been maintained. And in response to Putin's crackdown, that's what came forward.
So I know we are going to want to turn back to the other T word in a second, but let's stick with the book for right now. You have these sort of four main characters, these young people, but you also have these sort of three intellectual protagonists. And one of them is Alexander Dugin, who has become, in a sense, the chief ideologist behind Putinism, even though he wasn't like personally close to Putin, as far as we understand it. Tell us what you think about this debate, and there is a debate about whether there really is an ideology of Putinism beyond just maintaining power for Putin. This is one of the big arguments in our sort of world of Russia watchers, and the reason I think it's particularly relevant right now is this question of what kind of a conflict are we facing between Russia and the West, between Russia and the United States. It actually depends a little bit on how you assess their ideology, whether they have an ideology, and if so, you know, how it plays out. So tell us a little bit about your study of Alexander Dugin. He didn't cooperate, unlike the other characters in this book.
Well, he cooperated in a very peculiar way. He sent me stuff, and he sent me his right-hand person to talk to me. So I interviewed him by proxy, but he also has a vast written record and actually, I want to just give a shout out to Anton Shakhovtsov, who's here, who knows so much more about Alexander Dugin than I ever will. And who has a new book out on Russia and the European far right. The ideology question, actually, I'm not sure is the right question, and I'll explain. Ideology is also something that looks coherent usually in hindsight. When you read contemporary accounts of, say, Hitler's Germany, which we imagine to have had, you know, a very clear ideology, Victor Klemperer talks about how they are opportunists and they just pick up whatever is handy to make a particular argument. Eric Fromm writes that they have no ideology whatsoever, and the very idea that Hitler has an ideology is misguided. Hannah Arendt writes later than Fromm that that one of the reasons that the West was that the other Western countries were so slow to understand what was going on in Germany and in the Soviet Union was that the ideology on the face of it seemed preposterous. That if you tell somebody that they're going to kill millions of people because of their ethnicity, it sounds preposterous. If you tell somebody that their ideology is to eradicate entire classes of people to the tune of millions of people, it sounds preposterous. Only once it's happened does it become believable, even if it's still unimaginable. And then it starts to add up to coherent ideology. So I think, you know, once you've immersed yourself in those accounts, you actually think, this guy doesn't have less of an ideology than any of those. I think he has struck a couple of themes that are consistent. And one has a lot of traction, and that's traditional values, right? It began in part with queerbaiting the protesters, and because that turned out to be so effective, it's turned into this full-fledged sort of idea of a traditional value civilization. And that's Dugin's idea, and a Russian world, and Russia as the center of a civilization based on traditional values. That's as coherent as it gets.
Well, I know the audience has a lot of questions, and I'm going to look for our microphone so that you can raise your hands and do it. While you're getting your questions ready, I'll throw a final one to Masha before turning it over to you, the audience. Back to the other T word. You've written, and I'm sure many people here are familiar with your very powerful essay in the New York Review of Books, suggesting that, you know, the threat of Trump has to really do with the question of the kind of society we have here in the United States. So now that it's 230 days into the Trump presidency, what is your own progress report on the state of American democracy under Trump? Do you feel that your predictions are coming true?
I do, unfortunately. I think that, and if you recall, you don't have to recall, I recall that in that essay, but also later, sort of more vividly, when Samantha Bee asked me what my greatest fear was, and I said, nuclear holocaust. And, back in January, it seemed like a kind of nutty thing to say. We're in October now, and we've been living with the specter of a nuclear holocaust for a month and a half now. That's how fast it has advanced, and I think that Trump's attack on American institutions, and even more significantly to my mind, on American political culture, has been as unceasing as it could possibly have been. I didn't actually imagine that it would be this cacophonous, but I think the cacophony makes it that much more effective.
You mean cacophonous from inside the Trump administration, which clearly is not yet singing with one voice?
I mean that, but I also mean, you know, the just endless barrage of news. I mean, I'm Putin, when he came to power, and you know, all of us have sort of, again, our own heuristics, right? When Putin came to power, he set in motion a kind of authoritarian crawl, right? He was very methodical about taking over power, but every step was measured, and I think that that's part of what made it so effective in his case, was that every single thing he did on its face wasn't that awful, you know, until 2004 when he canceled gubernatorial elections. But basically up until that point, everything he did was kind of horrible, but not, you know, not, it was difficult actually to make the argument in the Western media, I know I tried, that he was establishing an authoritarian regime. And, you know, Trump has been acting like a bull in the china shop from day one. There has been no crawl. There's like this constant sort of artillery attack.
And on that note, who wants to be the first to jump in with a question?
Suzanne, can you talk about Putin's wealth and how he came by that and the oligarchs in Russia, and how do the people feel about the failed attempt at, you know, an actual kind of democracy? Thank you.
That's at least three questions. So I'm going to focus on the last of those three questions, because it actually has to do with what's in this book as opposed to a much earlier book about Putin. So how do people feel about the failed attempt at democracy? Well, we no longer know. That's how profound the transformation of Russian society has been. There's a moment in the book that's very important to me when Lev Gutkov, the sociologist, he has taken a piece of paper and he has graphed, he has superimposed two graphs. The graph of Putin's popularity, which skyrocketed after the invasion of Ukraine and held at 86%. So it looks like a vertical line up from 50-something to 86, and then it just holds, it plateaus. And the graph of consumer confidence, which is actually sort of a more broadly a sense of economic well-being, which plummeted around the same time, just as the Russian economy tanked, and stayed and plateaued at the bottom. And so it looks like this. And he held this up and he said, this can't happen. This is impossible, right? These two lines have to meet. Either this goes up or this goes down, or most likely both of them, one goes up and the other one goes down. The fact that it hasn't means that it's no longer a society in which you can meaningfully measure public opinion, because there's no public and there's no opinion.
I'm Vernon. Since you were talking about anniversaries earlier, and it's almost the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik.
I can't. Something, yeah, there's.
If you hold it closer to your mouth.
Sorry. Since we're also coming up on the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, I was wondering how much you feel that Putin, the KGB agent, is influenced by the Soviet political culture and structure, and how much he represents a break from that.
Oh, I think he's a KGB agent through and through. That's the nature of the beast. And what I think is important, and what this book is about is how much he has been able to tap into a nostalgia for an imaginary Soviet Union and recreate aspects of that culture.
Okay.
No, go ahead. My name is Ruth, and given the different histories and different political cultures of Russia and the U.S., and given what you've termed the assault on American political culture by Trump, how successful do you think he will be in establishing a quasi-totalitarian regime here, if at all, and what would be the best resistance that you would suggest for the American population?
I don't think that there's a danger of totalitarianism in this country. Totalitarianism does require state terror. The reason that Putin has been able to tap into totalitarian culture is that there was state terror in the Soviet Union for at least 3 decades. And the memory of that terror has shaped the society that Russia has today. I think that Trump is an aspiring autocrat. He wants to rule like a tyrant. And that's a real risk. And it's a real risk, not in the sense that Americans will forfeit as many liberties as Russians have forfeited, but it's certainly, it will, I think there's a real risk to institutions and there's a real risk to political culture. And I think the way to resist it, obviously I'm in a great position to give advice on this because I had to flee my own country. That's one way, yeah, New Zealand seems like a nice place, but I think that in this country, we have to be really aware of what we have, right? There have been aspiring tyrants, aspiring autocrats, as long as there have been democracies, right? And there have been people who wanted to destroy them, and never actually have they confronted a civil society this strong and a public sphere this healthy. And that's a strange thing to say because, we've all been bemoaning with good reason sort of the polarization in this country and the crisis of trust in the media. All of that is true. And still, I think a majority of people in this country are routinely exposed to opinions that they don't share. A majority of people get their news from different sources that don't speak with one voice. We have an absolutely extraordinarily wealthy and broad civil society, and we saw how it can act when the travel ban happened, and how civil society motivates institutions to act. We have to be really aware of that, and in part we have to be aware of it because we need to know that institutions don't actually function without civil society. Institutions will absolutely not save us. Only if civil society puts pressure on them and supports them will we have some hope of protecting what we have. But we also, have to understand that what we have is very much worth protecting.
Hi, my name is Jason, and my question relates to how Russia sort of interacts with the broader world. I've sort of noticed a pattern kind of in Russian history where, like some sort of catastrophic war, for example, will happen, like Napoleon attacks, and as a response, there's a push back to the West, so Alexander then seizes much of Poland. Or after World War II, you see Stalin setting up this network of various satellite states in Central Europe. Do you see Putin as kind of actively following in that sort of pattern?
I actually would disagree with your narrative a bit. You've just told a story that actually Russia really loves to tell of how Russia is always under attack and counterattacks. I think probably a more accurate way of looking at it is to say that Russia has been an empire and it has had an expansive vector for most of its history. And it's not because it's under attack from the West. And that's very much in play now. I think that one of the missed opportunities, and I do talk about this in the book, is sort of the opportunity to develop a post-imperial identity. Right? The Soviet Union was an empire. It was an empire that that denied that it was an empire, but it broke apart like empires do. But there's still an empire left, this empire had the opportunity to start thinking of itself in a different way, and perhaps to not base its identity on greatness. And that didn't happen. And under Putin, it's very much sort of back to a great Russia. The the single great myth of Russian history now is World War II, which, as Lev Gutkov, again the sociologist, says, is the perfect myth because it shines its lights backwards and forwards. Backwards because it justifies all the terror that came before, and forwards because it explains how the Soviet Union became a superpower. And that's sort of that's at this point the source of Russian identity, and that in large part dictates its outsized ambition, its superpower scale ambition, and its expansive motion.
My name's Jacob, and I had a question that I think is sort of a follow-on to the preceding one, and it has to do with Turkey. And it seems to me that Erdogan in Turkey is really following a very similar strategy as Putin did in Russia, and it seems like Putin has offered him very close support in that process since the coup in July of, 2016. And I was wondering if you could talk about that relationship from your perspective and what you see as its future.
Yeah, I'm not at all an expert on Turkey, like not at all. So I really hesitate to talk about Turkey. One thing that I would say about that relationship is that it's been quite volatile. I mean, there was a moment, about 6 months before the coup, when it looked like there might be a war between Russia and Turkey. Right? And that's actually an important lesson for Americans, I think, right? Here we have a president now who has promised a wonderful relationship with Russia, and the U.S. relationship with Russia is at its lowest point, possibly since World War II, right? At the point of mutually expelling diplomats, at a point when the U.S. embassy in Russia has stopped issuing visas because they no longer have the people power to issue visas. Trump has suggested closing the consulate in San Francisco. I mean, it's just spiraling. And I think that's the Erdogan-Putin example is a good example of how unreliable autocratic friendships are and how volatile they can be.
Hi, my name is Tina. I have a question about the protests that were going on earlier this year. So it seems that people like Navalny really capitalized on discontent with the lack of economic growth for the middle classes. So the richer were getting a lot richer, and then there was sort of a stagnation or almost a loss of economic power in the middle classes and the people that were less well off. And it seems like there is continued interest in going out and doing something or protesting on the streets, at least in the bigger cities. And then, of course, Navalny was arrested, but do you see that discontent is going away, or are they neutralizing it in some way, or is it still there and just not finding expression in any kind of systemic, organized fashion?
So the question concerns protests that there have been two waves of protests this year, and probably one more coming in the spring, and then in June, when called upon by Alexei Navalny, who started out as an anti-corruption blogger and has become sort of a leading light for a lot of people in Russia, people came out into the streets to protest corruption all over Russia. In June, people came out in over 100 cities and towns, so the most geographically spread out protests in Russian history, I believe. And the regime responded by arresting 1,725 people in one day. So the largest wave of arrests in a single day in decades. I think that gives us a pretty good indication of how this is going to play out. But to me, the saddest thing about those protests, as much as I have lots of problems with Navalny's politics, but I admire his inventiveness and his courage immensely. And as much as I admire the people who came out to protest, there was something really tragic to me about those protests. And that was how both the number of very, very young people in them, but even more so the way that older people, and by older people I mean anybody over 25, interpreted them, right? All over Russian social networks and in what little independent media there is, there was this sentiment, oh, this is the new generation that's finally going to make change. And they're talking about 17-year-olds. And a lot of the people who are talking about the 17-year-olds and even the 15-year-olds are people in their mid-30s who were the young faces of protest 5 years ago and who have already given up on themselves and on their entire generation and are passing the baton to the next generation. To me, that was especially painful because I had just finished writing this book, a lot of which is about this idea of generational change, right? And ultimately whether generational change is stronger than intergenerational trauma. The sociologist who, I keep mentioning him more than the other characters, but he offers incredible analysis, the team that he worked for in 1989 went out to do a survey based on this hypothesis that the Soviet man, Homo Sovieticus, was bound to be a dying breed because it had been decades, more than a generation, since Stalin's terror ended. And so people with a living memory of terror were dying off, and that would mean that Soviet man was dying off, and that would mean that Soviet institutions that rested on Soviet man would crumble, and that would bring the Soviet Union down. So they had this optimistic hypothesis. They went out, they did a survey, they concluded that they were right. 2 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed right on schedule. And in another 3 years, they went back to do that survey again and got really weird results that suggested that Homo Sovieticus was not dying off, was surviving. And 5 years after that, they did it again and concluded, and I quote, that Homo Sovieticus is not only thriving but reproducing. And they keep getting results that affirm that theory, and they don't see that person, that traumatized survivor of a totalitarian society, going anywhere. And so the way that one generation sort of looked at the next and said, okay, let the school children do it, just depressed the hell out of me.
Hi, my name is Sophie, and I study China. Oh, sorry. Where there's also been an upsurge in nationalism and also a crackdown on not democracy, because they don't have that, but on civil society within roughly the same period of time. And in connection with that, there's also been a real upsurge, I think, in propaganda about traditional gender roles. And so I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the impact of increasing authoritarianism in Russia on gender equality. Separately, you've spoken about the connection between trauma as a sort of collective national experience and how that can be exploited by governments to implement totalitarianism. And I wonder if you think that it also works perhaps in the opposite direction, that repairing trauma on an individual level can have a revolutionary impact. Should the National Endowment for Democracy be adding a line item for therapy for their the grants that they ask people to apply for?
Oh my God, that is such a great idea. I think the answer is no one has tried that, but that sounds like such an amazing project. And you know, you can't go wrong with a project like that. Like, you can't fail, at least on the individual level. You'll help people, which is more than you can say for a lot of democracy advancement projects. Gender roles. It always gets really complicated when we talk about gender roles in Russia. Because it seems so contradictory with women equally represented in the workplace and a lot of female-headed households and all of that. But so that said, and then like the complication acknowledged, there's been both, I think, rhetorically and really socially a real sort of reversion in the last, under Putin. I mean, Putin is, there's the great anecdote that Hillary Clinton told to Putin, told to David Remnick in, when he was interviewing her about her book, where she asked Putin, and I haven't gotten to that place in the book, I don't know if it's in the book as well, but she was looking for something that she could discuss with Putin, and he's very interested in nature conservation, which is also something I know a little bit about. And so she said to him, she asked him a question about that, and he just lit up and started talking to her. And he said, in fact, I'm about to go to Chukotka to place a satellite collar on a polar bear. Maybe Bill wants to come with me, he says to the Secretary of State of the United States. And she says, well, Bill might be busy. I could come with you. And he just ignores it. And that's sort of, you know, that's the culture, very very much the reigning culture. I mean, Putin has also been known to be to respond to a question asked by a woman journalist, you know, and how many children have you had? And a lot of the rhetoric underlying the anti-gay campaign has actually had to do with reproduction and demographics. And I think part of the reason that it's been so successful is because it does tap into a real demographic panic. Right. So all of that has not been great for gender equality and more equal gender roles. And the, you know, the incredible emphasis now on traditional values, whatever that might mean, and sort of the imaginary past when we had those traditional values, ultimately, you know, is just going to exacerbate that situation.
Hi, my name is Leah. I just wanted to thank you for being here. So my question was that in other revolutions, like for example in the Arab Spring, social media has been a really effective tool for mass mobilization of oppositions. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how, why you think that, given how unregulated social media and the internet are generally, why you think the opposition hasn't really effectively used it to, I guess,
Right. So I wouldn't say that the opposition hasn't effectively used social networks or social media. Here's what I would say. First of all, I would say that there is no opposition in Russia. Right? What I mean is that opposition is a word that suggests access to public sphere, access to media, access to electoral institutions. None of that exists. Right. So there are opponents to Putin who publicize, who spread information and who sometimes organize protests. That's very different from saying that there's an opposition. And it has a lot to do with why the potential of how the potential of social media is limited, right? Social media cannot create connections that don't exist offline. Right? It cannot create public space that really doesn't exist offline. It can speed up communication, and it can amplify messages, but only within the confines of what already exists offline. Right? And so when protests broke out, people were able to spread the message very, very quickly within existing networks, using social media, among other things. As often happens, the impact of social media was overestimated. Polls actually showed that about half the people who participated in protests in 2011-2012 learned about them from social media, and about half from other sources, right? But it played an important role. But it's not, you know, social media, as we have now finally learned in this country as well, is not inherently anything. It's not inherently democratic. It's not inherently a force for good. And it doesn't inherently, it doesn't create things that aren't already there. It just makes them more efficient.
Hi, my name is Natasha. I am also.
Okay, it's green now. Don't push. Try it now. No, don't push. Just
okay.
Talk now.
All right. Well, okay. So I'm originally from Moscow. My name is Natasha. I immigrated about 20. It was last year of the Soviet Union. I have a personal question. Actually, two interrelated personal questions. One is, you have been living in Moscow after you came back from the U.S. For quite some time, and now you are back in the U.S. I wanted to find out how you're finding this adjustment back to the U.S. And the second question, there is one of your books which is not political, which I really love. I read it a long time ago. It's called Blood Matters, and it's about genetics and your personal journey. And right now I understand that it's very important to write political books, but I'm wondering whether you are thinking about writing a non-political book again.
Wow, great question. So to the question of how the adjustment has been coming back here, so I first came here as a teenager in 1981, and then I went back to the Soviet Union, actually, as a correspondent in 1991 and stayed until December 2013 and then came back here. But all along I was writing in both English and Russian and writing books in English. So for me, coming back has actually been great. It's been a homecoming in a way. I live in New York City, which I love. I've had a very rewarding career for the last 4 years. It's been wonderful. What has been and I have to say that emigrating when you have a choice about it is definitely. I mean, even though I didn't have much of a choice about sort of the timing of leaving Russia, we had to get out in a hurry. But I made that decision myself, unlike the first time when my parents made the decision for me. And I was just resentful and miserable. But this time I brought my teenage children who were resentful and miserable. And I can't blame them because I know exactly what it feels like. And I have to say that there's a peculiar difficulty actually to have a family in which four people immigrated, my partner and my three kids, and I came home. And that's really been a struggle because I think at least for people who emigrate, as difficult as it is, there's also kind of a rewards ladder, right? Because you go from working illegally under the table to actually having a regular job to then finding a job in your field. There's a rapid kind of growth that compensates for that loss of social networks and social status that that people inevitably experience when they emigrate. And I deprived my family of that because we came here quite comfortably, bought a house, moved in, but the misery of dislocation is still there, and there's nothing you can do about it. To answer your question about whether I'm thinking of writing a personal book, I am thinking of writing a personal book, but it's like years down the road. If I do write it, it will be a book about emigration and gender.
Hi, thank you for coming. My question is, I was wondering if you were able to get outside of Moscow into some of the other cities, and whether you were able to talk with some of the various other ethnic groups in Russia, and what were your experiences? Thanks.
In my work as a journalist in Russia, I was mostly a roving reporter, and I traveled all over the country and did a lot of reporting on from different cities, including a lot of reporting on non-Russian ethnic groups and non-Orthodox Christians. This book is built around seven particular people, two of whom are not from Moscow, and the rest of them are from Moscow. They so one of them grew up in a provincial, well, a large, actually, no, he didn't start out in a large city. He started out in a very small town, provincial town, then moved to a larger provincial city, and then had to actually flee Russia altogether. And he is, I think he's an absolutely extraordinary character, a young academic who was very hopeful just a few years ago, started the first gender studies center at a Russian university and had really found himself sort of in academia. And then a couple of years later was running for his life and now lives in New York. And another of the characters is Boris Nemtsov's daughter, who grew up also in a provincial city, but a very large one, Nizhny Novgorod, Zhanna Nemtsova. And she also has had to leave the country following her father's assassination.
We have time for three more quick questions.
Hi, I'm Julie. I'm trying to figure out exactly how to word this, but I work for LGBT rights, and it's been really shocking for me. I did not expect Trump to come after the LGBT community the way he has. And then, you know, with the release of the Department of Health and Human Services plan, which is basically a fundamentalist plan yesterday, I'm wondering, with both Putin and Trump, how core you think misogyny and homophobia is to their, how they function and how it ties in with their political worldview or not. Is it kind of coincidental? I mean, you've talked a lot about traditional values, but a little more about that role, the role those play.
You know, that's a really interesting question, because I've actually puzzled over this American obsession with core values, right? Like, why do we care if somebody is deeply racist if they behave like a racist? Why do we care if somebody is deeply homophobic if they're president and they encourage homophobic policies, you know, or launch an anti-gay campaign? It doesn't matter. You know, what matters is what they actually do and what becomes our observed reality. Our observed reality is that this president is Trump, I mean, but the other one in Russia too, is going after LGBT people in a fairly concerted manner, right? I have my ideas about why he's doing it. I think because for someone like him, and this was calculable, and I wrote about this very early on. In July of 2016, I wrote that he was going to reverse progress on LGBT rights. Because for someone like him, it makes sense to reverse the most pronounced, most recent, most rapid social change in this country. And that concerns LGBT rights. And it doesn't matter how he feels about LGBT people and whether all of his best friends are gay. It really makes no difference, right? His power is largely based on his ability to demonstrate that he's serious about taking people to the past. And that will necessarily involve reversing progress on LGBT rights. And I think we should expect a lot more attacks on that front.
Hi, my name is Nancy. Oops. Have the economic sanctions that the West has imposed and or the Magnitsky Act provided any constraints on Putin and his regime and those around him?
I think so. And I also, I'm starting to be like a broken record in saying I don't think this is a great question, but this is the way we normally pose the question, right? We normally ask whether sanctions are effective. You know, it's a perfectly reasonable question, of course. But I also think that when you deal with someone like Putin, who's basically intractable, right, that question can also lead to a logical dead end, right? Because if there's no way to influence his behavior, then there's no way to influence his behavior. So what's the point of sanctions? Well, the point of sanctions is that they're the right thing to do, because it is the wrong thing to do business with the bloody dictator. It is the wrong thing to do to allow, you know, him and his people to invest their money here and to launder their money here. So whether or not we can see we can observe strategic results from sanctions. Sanctions are the right thing to do.
My name is George. Just one question. What happens after Putin?
Last question.
Oh, well, that's an easy one. I have no idea. But actually, there's a wonderful book that's just out in paperback that is weirdly relevant to that question. And the book is called Last Days of Stalin. Have you read it? It was great. It's Joshua Rubinstein. It's a slim book, and it's amazing. You read it, and the part that has to do with how the U.S. foreign policy establishment was worried that after Stalin died, the hardliners might come to power. That really, I thought that was really amazing. And so it really puts into perspective similar fears that have been voiced repeatedly in this country. But I also, the other thing that has direct implications for today is that he has documented in how much disarray the Soviet Union was and how Americans looking at it couldn't believe that it was in that much disarray and kept looking for sort of hidden meanings and hidden strategies. And actually what had happened was that Stalin had planned to live forever. There was no succession plan. Nobody knew what was happening and how they should act, and anything was possible. And I think something similar is going to happen after Putin dies. He definitely plans to live forever. There will be no succession plan. I'm assuming that it will be his death that will end Putinism. If it's something else, it will not be dissimilar. We'll know it when it happens, right? It's a closed system. But there will be disarray. One prediction that I feel confident enough making is that I don't think that Russia will stay in its current borders when after Putin. It's there's so much sort of outward tension at this point. Putin has managed to put so much pressure on various constituent members of the Russian Federation, and pump them for money and do the opposite and pump money into supporting friendly dictators in various places. Once he's gone, sort of those tensions will come to the surface, and various parts of Russia will break off. So we'll see major rearrangement when he's gone.
All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.